Hello, everyone, and welcome to the PMA Ask the Expert podcast series. Today's session is entitled Understanding Vaccinations and Autoimmune Diseases. My name is Roberta Peche, and I'm the Research and Project Manager at the Transverse Myelitis Association. We are a nonprofit focused on support, education, and research of rare neuroimmune diseases. You can learn more about us on our website at myelitis.org. Chitra Krishnan, Executive Director of the PMA, will be moderating our podcast for today. A few housekeeping pieces before we get started. This podcast is being recorded and will be made available on the TMA website at myelitis.org. It can also be downloaded via iTunes. During the call, if you have any additional questions, please send them to us via our Facebook page at facebook.com/myelitis.
Great. Thank you, Roberta. We're excited to be joined by Drs. Benjamin Greenberg and Terry Schreiner on today's podcast. Dr. Greenberg is an associate professor at University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center. He is recognized internationally as an expert in rare autoimmune disorders of the CNS. Dr. Schreiner is a neuroimmunology specialist at the University of Colorado and a pediatric neurologist at Children's Hospital Colorado. She is subspecialized in pediatric onset demyelinating disorders of the CNS and has begun a multidisciplinary clinic for children with these disorders. We are so grateful to both of you for joining us. We've received many questions from our community, and this is a topic of great concern and interest. We really appreciate you both taking the time to address what is clearly a very complicated and difficult issue. To start us off, perhaps I can start with you, Dr. Greenberg. There is so much conversation in the community, as I said, about vaccinations and a lot of concern that vaccinations actually caused TM or NMO or ADEM. You know, from a public health perspective, when we talk about causation, we talk about many factors like the timing, a biological plausibility, and so much more. When you think about the context of vaccinations and these rare neuroimmune diseases, is it possible, is it even biologically plausible that vaccines can cause TM, NMO, ADEM, or acute flaccid myelitis?
Well, Chitra, first let me just thank you and Roberta and the TMA for sponsoring this podcast and the podcast series, and Dr. Schreiner for taking part in a controversial area and an area that needs a lot of work and research done. For many years, in fact, decades, people have talked about the potential complications of vaccinations leading to different neurologic conditions. And it's been well documented in the lay press as well as the literature, concerns about links between vaccinations and autism, concerns about links between vaccinations and multiple sclerosis, concerns between about vaccinations and the link to transverse myelitis or Guillain-Barré. In all of these areas, there has yet to be a study that proves a link between them. Now, the lack of evidence does not disprove a theory, but it's important from the outset of the conversation to have a framework for this conversation. And what I'd like to do is just take 60 seconds and talk about the two different theories that would biologically link a vaccination to one of these conditions, like transverse myelitis. And the two theories are, first, the theory of molecular mimicry. And what that theory says is that part of the vaccine, part of the proteins of the organism that we are exposing a human to in order to build protection. So, for example, a flu vaccine or a measles vaccine has the whole or part of the measles virus or the flu virus in it, and we inject it or ingest it so that the human being develops resistance to that organism. The molecular mimicry theory states that there are proteins within the spinal cord or within the nervous system that look very similar to the proteins of the virus, and after the immune system gets activated against flu or against measles or hepatitis or any of these viruses, in the aftermath, by mistake, it goes in and causes inflammation in the brain or spinal cord, leading to one of these autoimmune conditions. So the molecular mimicry theory states that a specific protein in a specific vaccine triggers an immune response against the host. The second theory that links vaccinations to these autoimmune conditions does not specifically need a certain protein from a virus. This theory states that there are people who are predisposed or are in fact incubating these autoimmune conditions, meaning they are walking around with everything necessary in their biology to have a transverse myelitis event or an ADEM event or a multiple sclerosis attack or an NMO attack, and that the vaccination leads to generalized inflammation that triggers a pre-existing condition. Those two theories are very different and have a huge impact on the way we do research relative to vaccinations, because in the first theory, we would need to prove that a very specific vaccine, so just the flu vaccine, was a trigger for people's transverse myelitis. And in the second theory, what we need to show is, frankly, any vaccination, when exposed to a prepped individual, would lead to these conditions. So there are two biologically plausible theories that could link vaccinations to these events. Unfortunately, as we talk about on today's call, we're going to go through the data and talk about where we're missing data and where the data has either substantiated or not substantiated these claims.
Okay, this is Terry Schreiner. I think I'll just jump in there and say, yeah. I think that is a wonderful overview of the scenario that we are looking at, which is very complex and comes up so often in clinic. And so it's a pleasure to be able to have a discussion today and to address some particular questions regarding this very pertinent topic. I will add just a couple things to what Dr. Greenberg has already very eloquently described, which is that we refer to vaccines as if they are all the same, and we know that there are different types. That's important to consider as we look at all the evidence and think about, you know, which types, if there were any link, would be more prone to cause an immune response. And also, we think and in some circumstances have had research evaluate the interaction between the different types of vaccines and the different types of demyelination. But we know that not all demyelination is the same. So multiple sclerosis is a much different disease than acute disseminated encephalomyelitis, and that myelitis itself has many different causes. And so there's a complexity within the system when we look at all of these different factors that we need to take into account as we weigh the evidence.
That's great. Thank you, Dr. Schreiner. I you know, that's a fantastic overview from both of you. So if I had to sort of pick, you know, a particular vaccine that we've gotten many, many, many questions about, and most of them have been that, you know, I received a flu shot and 2 days later I was diagnosed with transverse myelitis, or 6 weeks later I was diagnosed with transverse myelitis. So are there any known risks associated with receiving flu shots for those with TM? And conversely, are there accompanying risks to contracting flu that might have been prevented with the vaccination? Dr. Schreiner, do you want to start this one?
Yeah, I will start this one. So so this is, I've mentioned that vaccines in general are a topic that comes up quite often in clinic, but I think of them, this is the question that I receive most often is, you know, should I get a flu shot? I've never had the flu. I'm not going to get that because, you know, I just never get sick. And I think that this is something worth clarifying, that the evidence that we have shows that the potential impact on disease, and I'll just say demyelinating disease in general, is much more significant from the influenza infection itself than it is from the vaccine. So one particular study looking at this looked just at multiple sclerosis patients. And what they found was, among patients who are already diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, the risk of having an exacerbation, a new neurologic problem related to demyelination, was significantly higher in the 3 months after having had the flu, the actual infection, than it was after getting a flu shot. And so I recommend for all of my patients that they be immunized against influenza to prevent the infection. Now, you know, all of us have to accept a certain uncertainty in how efficacious the flu vaccine is going to be. And unfortunately, this year we're seeing that the flu vaccine is not very efficacious, but it is still something that is recommended to prevent the infection in at least 23% of the people who receive it. Dr. Greenberg, do you have anything to add with regards to the flu?
So, yeah, I guess there's a couple things when it comes to flu that I would add. So one thing, and this is specific to the flu virus vaccination, is no two vaccines are the same year to year. And so there is no such thing as a singular flu vaccine. So when people have concerns that in the past they had a reaction or event with the flu vaccine, and I get the question, can I ever have it again? The answer is you're never going to have that flu vaccine again. You're going to have a very different flu vaccine. And so one of the concerns that comes up about repeated exposure is not one we have when it comes to flu vaccine. The second issue that comes up, and Chitra, you alluded to this, is people will report that I had a flu vaccine, and in the days, weeks, or months after, I had my event. So that is what is used as evidence to show causation. And unfortunately, it can be a misnomer. And what we see is that it is human nature. I do it myself, that if A precedes B, A must have caused B. And in this respect, it's even more so along those lines because there's a theory that would link the two. Unfortunately, when you do the statistics of how many transverse myelitis cases there are a year, and you break them down into seasons, and you look at, well, if there's, let's say there's 100 cases of transverse myelitis, there's more than that, but to make numbers simple, there's 100 cases and it's evenly distributed throughout the year. That means 25 cases are going to happen in November, December, and January. The peak for flu vaccinations are September, October, November. That means even if there was no association, no cause between the flu vaccine and transverse myelitis, a quarter of transverse myelitis cases will happen within 3 months of the vaccination. So even in a world where there is no association, we could be fooled individually into thinking there is one just by random chance. So from an epidemiologic perspective, what we would want to show is, geez, there is a spike in transverse myelitis cases in the time period after vaccinations. And every study that's looked at the demyelinating diseases has failed to find this temporal association that we can find individuals. And in fact, you would expect to find individuals who have the event after the vaccination, but at a population pattern, that pattern hasn't been there. And the last comment I make, which is to echo what Dr. Schreiner said about the dangers of flu, this season I have personally cared for more children with post-flu neurologic events than for children with post-vaccination events. I have not had, thankfully, a child in-house with transverse myelitis in the 90 days after flu vaccine yet this season, but we have had 2 to 3 kids in the hospital with post-flu neurologic events. And so while we all weigh the risks and benefits of putting things in our body, we do have to recognize there are distinct advantages when rolling the dice with taking the vaccination.
That's great. Thank you. And, you know, so this also, you know, you mentioned 90 days, and we just got a question on Facebook about this as well. You know, so what would ordinarily be a time frame that you would consider biological plausibility? 3 months, the cutoff?
Yeah, I don't think anybody knows. So it depends on which theory you're talking about. So if you're talking about molecular mimicry, in theory, there isn't a specific time cutoff. In theory, you could get a vaccination this year that primes your immune system against a protein, and then far later in your life, it gets triggered to actually give you the event. Whereas in the other theory, where the vaccination is the trigger for the pre-existing autoimmune condition, you would expect for it to trigger it, you know, I would argue scientifically within 60 days, really within 30 days. And likewise, you can make the argument that some reactions would be too soon to be biologically plausible. So, for example, somebody having symptoms within 24 hours after the vaccination, that's probably not long enough for it to trigger a spinal cord event. And so there's probably a window anywhere from 3 days to 30 days where biologically I would consider it plausible that there was a potential link. Again, though, if you do the math on a population level, if people get transverse myelitis by eating a bad turkey sandwich and they happen to have that turkey sandwich around the time they get the vaccination, there's no way to separate out which was the culprit. And I should mention at this point, because I do want to recognize one thing. Sometimes I think comments like this and conversations like this, since it is such a charged area, can come across as being dogmatic about this. And I don't want to come across that way. I do believe, and in fact there is proof, that certain vaccines have induced neurologic events in the past, specifically ADEM or TM. And the best example of this is the Semple rabies vaccine. This was when we used to grow the rabies virus in neurons, in brain tissue, basically, and then inject it into humans to vaccinate against rabies. Well, if I inject brain and spinal cord tissue into humans, it's quite probable that I'm going to get an immune response against brain or spinal cord. And so I know that in the past there have definitely been vaccines that clearly had an association with neurologic events. Fortunately, today, the manufacturing processes don't involve those human tissues or neuronal tissues. So I think we've gotten to a place where the odds of it happening are just significantly lower.
And I'll make one addition, if I may, is that in looking at the literature, the number of cases that have linked a vaccination with development or presentation of a demyelinating episode, the spectrum of time between the vaccination and the presentation of neurologic symptoms that would be the disease is quite variable. Anything from days, as Dr. Greenberg mentioned, to up to 5 or 6 months or even years. And that is worrisome. We've talked about examples like the turkey sandwich of trying to identify causation when there are different things happening to us every day of our lives, and how to draw a link between one thing such as a vaccination and a disease that will develop months, if not years later, is really fraught with so many difficulties and presumptions. So I think we need to be conscious of thinking about things like that, but I share the thought that we probably can't assume that anything happening within a couple days of a vaccine, any demyelinating episode happening within a couple days, is causal. Likewise, I carry a heavy dose of skepticism that anything happening, you know, months later, up to years later, I seriously doubt that that would be related.
That's great. Thank you. So, you know, given the time frame and given the fact that, you know, there are, like you said, rabies vaccination has been shown, et cetera, you know, are there any circumstances where you would tell a person not to get vaccinated, you know, or is it a specific vaccination, or do you give them sort of any guidance that if it's a live virus, you need to be, or live attenuated virus, you need to be careful, or if you're sick, don't get it? I mean, are there any guidelines one should think about if you've been diagnosed with any one of these diseases, you know, when you should get vaccinated and when not?
Yeah, Chitra, I'll jump in on this one. The issue of live versus killed vaccines, and it's important just to note the difference for listeners who may not be aware of this. So there are two ways to three ways in theory to vaccinate people against infections or complications of infections. So one is to take a weakened version of the live virus. So you take a flu virus, you grow it over many generations to the point where it's really not going to make you that sick, and then we ingest it or inject it into a human. So for flu, this is the nasal mist, the flu mist, that gets squirted into a nose, and it will give you a mild infection that really doesn't make you that sick, but gives your body a chance to mount a response to it. So that's a live attenuated virus vaccine. The second type is a killed virus, where you take the whole virus, it's killed, and the carcasses are injected into the person, and you mount an immune response because the proteins are there, and the immune system can see the proteins and learn to attack it in the future. And it won't replicate and can't cause the actual illness. It can make you feel sick, so most people who get a flu shot will get a low-grade fever. It's not because they get the flu, it's because their immune system's getting activated as if they had the flu and is mounting that response. And then the last type of vaccine is a conjugated protein vaccine, where instead of giving you the whole dead carcass of a virus or a live virus, we just take one piece or two pieces of proteins and inject it in. So the tetanus vaccination is to a protein. So one of the big discussions that comes up is there a difference in danger between these different vaccines? And the most attention gets cast towards live viral vaccinations versus the dead or protein-based. And in general, the safety record for each of them has been exactly the same. Relative to triggering autoimmune events, we do not see any difference in history between the live attenuated viruses and the killed or the protein-based viruses. There is one exception to this that our patients need to be aware of, and it specifically is most appropriate for our NMO patients, and that is for anybody who is on an immunosuppressant, whether it be a steroid or mycophenolate mofetil, which is sold as CellCept, or azathioprine, which is sold as Imuran, or rituximab, which is sold as Rituxan. Any of these drugs, any immunosuppressant, is a contraindication to taking a live attenuated virus, because now what was a weakened virus to a normal host may become a full-blown virus to you. So for our patients who are on immunosuppression or have recently been treated with immunosuppressants, so maybe you're just getting over your transverse myelitis and you're on a steroid taper or just finished a steroid taper, then it is worth discussing the timing and whether or not you should take a live vaccine. For individuals who are not on immunosuppression or have not had a recent exposure to immunosuppression, in general, I consider the safety / risk profile of the live and the dead viruses to basically be the same. So for an idiopathic transverse myelitis patient, I would not personally in my clinic distinguish between those two.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it's worth noting as well that many live virus vaccines are used only in very special circumstances. So yellow fever vaccine, oral typhoid, or BCG for tuberculosis, these are vaccinations that are used only upon traveling to specific destinations or going into endemic areas. So they are not in the vaccination schedule of the CDC, nor are they anything you're likely to encounter unless you're traveling to an endemic area. Likewise, the oral polio vaccine, which has in the past been implicated with vaccine-associated paralytic polio, that is no longer used in the U.S. So among the live virus vaccines that one is likely to come into contact with, that would be the flu mist, the intranasal influenza, and measles and rotavirus, which is only used in very, very young children. So we're talking about a small subset of vaccines that are used commonly.
And thank you both. And since you sort of bring up, childhood vaccinations, we've received, quite a few questions and concerns around, if someone's been diagnosed with, say, idiopathic TM, how long would you wait following the acute episode before resuming childhood vaccinations? And part two of this is it safe to give, all the childhood vaccinations on the recommended schedule? Would you spread them out? Would you give them one at a time? Would you give them the way it's given? There's you know, a lot of concern around receiving childhood vaccinations. Dr. Schreiner, can I ask you this question to start us off?
Yes, yes, absolutely. So I'll start with the first question that you posed, which was if a child is just getting over what is presumed to be an idiopathic transverse myelitis, when might it be appropriate to resume a vaccination schedule? And I will second what Dr. Greenberg had said a moment earlier, which is if you were within, I would say, a month or perhaps two of receiving high-dose steroids, which is commonly used to treat transverse myelitis, I would probably wait to give vaccinations until after that time period. And the reason is the high-dose steroids that we use on purpose to calm down the immune system, so to quell the inflammatory response in an idiopathic transverse myelitis, it doesn't discern calming down in one area of the body but not in another. And so administering a vaccine to someone who has a lowered immune system is not only unlikely to benefit the patient because they won't be able to generate an immune response that we're hoping for with a vaccine, but if they are getting, for example, a live virus vaccine, it's risky, and that would be an exception that I would take. But I do believe that everybody should be getting their vaccines. Now, the CDC has a very prescribed time period for giving each of the recommended vaccines. And they also have a complementary schedule, which is, okay, if you fall behind, if you miss a vaccine or six, you know, here's how you go about making up for the delay in vaccination. And so there is a very formal way of catching up if you have missed a couple. Is there any advantage to breaking them up? So, for example, you know, at 4 months, 2, 4, and 6 months, and I know we're talking about very young patients here, there are, you know, 5, 6 vaccines that are recommended at each of those time points. And so one question I often get is, you know, I really don't want to give all of these vaccines on the same day, even in a healthy child. You know, can I break them up? Can I do it instead of, you know, 6 doses at 2 months and 6 at 4 and 6 at 6 months? Can I give half of them at 2 months? Or half of the 2 month shots at 2 months and the other at 3 months and so forth? Can I spread them out? Can I give the vaccinations over a longer period of time? And I don't think there is a contraindication to doing that. I don't think there's any disadvantage other than perhaps, you know, well, certainly having more injections spread over a longer period of time, but I don't actually feel that it's necessary per se. Even in the case of getting over a demyelinating event, assuming you are not immunocompromised, I don't know that there's an advantage to taking a combination vaccine like diphtheria, tetanus, and acellular pertussis, and breaking that down into 3 injections instead of just one. So I'm not opposed to it when families come to me wanting to do that, but I don't think that there's a strong advantage to doing so.
Dr. Greenberg, any thoughts to add?
No, I mean, I agree. I think Dr. Schreiner kind of laid everything out quite nicely. I will just mention one thing that we haven't brought up yet, but falls into this category of delaying or even avoiding childhood vaccinations, and that is we do need to remember that the reason we're vaccinating is to prevent some very serious, sometimes life-threatening conditions like measles, like pertussis. We've had outbreaks of pertussis here in Texas that killed multiple infants. We've had a measles outbreak in California going on right now. And the people who are most susceptible are our youngest. And several of the cases, in fact, to my knowledge, all of the cases so far have been in people who either delayed or did not get vaccinated. And so we just need to remember that we are taking risks when we delay, and it's during those delayed times that kids are most susceptible to the really scary versions of these diseases. Now, that said, I will mention that there are times after an acute transverse myelitis that I do hold off on a vaccination, partly because of getting off the steroids, but also partly because with vaccinations, it's very common for all of us to get low-grade fevers because your immune response is being activated against the vaccine. We want that. That's the whole point. But for a lot of our kiddos who are working through rehab and trying to get symptom management under control, sometimes I'll say, you know what, let's just wait a couple months if we have the luxury of waiting so that we don't derail or take away from any of the rehab. During flu season, however, for all of our patients, we want them vaccinated. It's a killed virus. It can be done. And the worst thing that would happen is during recovery after an event to get actual flu would actually just set people back tremendously. So we advocate for flu.
Thank you, Bo. That was, a very, very clear response to the questions that we get asked a lot. Talking about combination vaccines, even since it's in kids, in adults, when people are traveling or people are getting, say, flu and Hep B, you would sort of say the same thing, that it's, you know, is it safe to have, you know, multiple vaccinations when you're traveling abroad if you've been diagnosed with TM?
Yeah, I'd say in general the answer is yes. I would just say that people need to be prepared for this phenomenon of during that low-grade fever, you know, could their symptoms transiently worsen? So I definitely have patients who've had transverse myelitis who get a vaccine home or abroad or anywhere, who for a few days after old symptoms become more intense and everybody worries about a relapse occurring or brewing. And when we look at these folks, we don't find any evidence of new inflammation, but it's pretty common with those low-grade fevers just to have old symptoms come back. So if you're doing it for traveling, you just need to be aware in the days after the vaccination, you may not feel so great, but it should wear off.
And that's a great point you bring up, because people have asked, you know, are you aware in your practice, you know, having a recurrent attack after receiving a vaccination? And in many cases, as you say, it's just a worsening of symptoms. At what point do you sort of differentiate between worsening of symptoms and a recurrent attack?
Well, I can tell you our approach, and I'd welcome Dr. Schreiner's kind of comments on this as well, because everybody, I think, has a slightly different approach. So in general, when we have a patient who's had prior inflammatory neurologic disease, transverse myelitis, ADEM, neuromyelitis optica, who contacts our clinic or presents with symptoms, they fall into two categories from the outset. They're either symptoms that have been experienced before, or they are symptoms that are completely new. So for example, if somebody's transverse myelitis gave them leg weakness and numbness 5 years ago, and they come in with a recurrence of weakness and numbness in those legs, then that would fit into the category of it's the old stuff returning. Whereas if they come in and say, my right arm isn't working, and I never had right arm issues, then it's in the latter. For the latter, we always presume it's in new inflammation until proven otherwise. So if an area of the body that's never been affected is affected, we work that up as a relapse. If somebody comes in and it's a reemergence of old symptoms, in our experience, statistically, it's almost always something else going on, not new inflammation. There's something called an Uthoff's phenomenon. So either there's a urinary tract infection, either there's a sinus infection, they haven't been eating well, they're dehydrated, they haven't slept well, maybe they got a vaccine and their immune system is activated, but something to throw their compensation off such that old symptoms become more pronounced. In my experience, we definitely have had that occur after vaccination. I've had several of my patients who in the couple days after a flu vaccine have had an intensification of prior symptoms. I personally have yet to document for any of my idiopathic transverse myelitis patients a single recurrence after vaccination. I am not aware of one, but I would definitely welcome Terry's kind of perspective on this.
No, I agree. I have not seen a recurrence of a transverse myelitis following vaccination or even illness after just an idiopathic TM, so meaning I have not seen new symptoms develop in a patient who has had just an idiopathic transverse myelitis. I do agree that anything that really disturbs the homeostasis of a patient who has had a prior demyelinating event is going to cause a unveiling, a return of symptoms that they have had in the past. And so when I receive a phone call from a patient or a family of a patient who says, you know, the patient is experiencing these symptoms. Yep, it's the same stuff they had a year ago, 2 years ago, 5 years ago. Then we kind of launch into an investigation of what's disturbing the homeostasis. Is the patient well? Do they have any sick symptoms? Is there any sign of a urinary tract infection? How have things been going? Sleeping well, eating well, and so forth. And most often that is where we find the explanation. There's something that has caused the unveiling of those symptoms from before. And once you attend to whatever that cause might be, the symptoms abate, and then the patient will return to their prior baseline. Duration of symptoms can also be a clue. So if there is some disturbance of homeostasis, there's something going on and we attend to it and the symptoms still don't improve, then we need to think a little bit harder about that. And if there is any new inflammation going on, it's going to last more than 24 hours. And so it's not going to be something transient that resolves within 5 minutes or 45 minutes or 2 hours or whatever.
Great, thank you. You know, I have about four questions that are about specific vaccines, and the first one is about shingles. Most people are being told, I mean, the question is, the primary doctor won't give it to me until a doctor who knows TM clears me since it's a live virus. Should I get the shingles shot? We've had a few questions about shingles. Do you have any thoughts about shingles specifically, Dr. Greenberg?
I think shingles hurts. That's my thought about shingles specifically. I don't want to get it. But in seriousness, it's a live vaccine, so it fits into that category I discussed before relative to it's probably got the same safety profile as the killed vaccines. Relative to risks for transverse myelitis or triggering an event, it's got its own safety profile in terms of can people get mild cases of shingles with it. That's extraordinarily rare. But in terms of triggering neurologic events, it's got a very good safety profile. Now, when talking about vaccinations, you know, we lump them, we spend a lot of time lumping them all together, and Chitra, I think it's a good idea to talk about some of the nuances for each. We mentioned that, for example, flu vaccine is different every year. The shingles vaccine is the same all the time. But the other thing that is different about these conditions is about what we're trying to protect against. So there are certain conditions we're trying to protect against. I think measles and flu are great examples where they are highly contagious. They can spread from person to person before an individual is symptomatic. And they are both linked with various serious complications, neurologic complications. And we have to remember that between 30 and 50,000 people die every year from flu or flu-related complications. So these are serious life-threatening, quality-of-life-threatening illnesses. Shingles, which for most, if we're talking about adult populations, the shingles vaccine is being given to people who had chickenpox as a child and is being recommended to reduce the risk of having a shingles outbreak later in life. Shingles is a painful, blistering rash. It can be associated with neurologic complications, although they're relatively rare. It's just really painful to get. And so in the adult populations, if I have adults who, for any reason, say, you know, I'm just not interested in the shingles vaccine, it doesn't represent the same level of outright concern to their health or well-being, frankly, as flu or measles in terms of risk of to life or limb. Now, in children, it's different. The reason we are vaccinating in children is to prevent them from getting chickenpox, varicella, which the primary infection is associated with neurologic complications. So in kids who have never had a chickenpox exposure, I put the shingles vaccine into the category of we should get it as long as you're not on immunosuppression. In the adult, I'm open to the conversation of saying, you know the risks and benefits and make a decision. All indications for vaccines are not made equally. And so I think we have to take each one, and I think shingles is a good example.
And Dr. Schreiner, what about MMR? I mean, so there have been a few questions about MMR as a vaccine. People are terrified to give it, give boosters after one, for example. Have there been any studies that have linked MMR with any one of these demyelinating diseases?
There have been studies looking at MMR, which is measles, mumps, and rubella, so vaccination, one vaccination against three different diseases, and studies looking at not only MMR with a separate immunization of varicella, but also the vaccination that is MMRV, which is all four of them together in one shot. And I don't know of any evidence that has linked that with an episode of demyelination. What is associated with the MMR vaccine is an increased risk of febrile seizures, particularly in young patients. But even so, it's a risk that's less than 1% of all vaccinations. I think it's 0.3%. But there is that risk that 7 to 10 days after the vaccination with an MMR, particularly because of the measles component, that their child would be at risk for a febrile seizure. And there are other side effects, not neurologic side effects, that have been associated rarely with MMR as well. But I think, again, to sort of reiterate what has been said, the benefit of being vaccinated against MMR, and I'll throw varicella in there as well, outweighs any of these risks. And so I am a proponent of using either MMR with the separate varicella or doing all four together in the MMRV. One aspect of vaccinations that I think has led to a degree of comfort in the population presently is this thing called herd immunity. And so if you vaccinate enough people in a community, then the ability of that virus, if it breaks into the community, to spread and infect people is significantly inhibited because you have a preponderance of people within that community who are vaccinated who will not be able to get that disease. So there are unvaccinated people in a community who may benefit by the fact that everybody else in the community is vaccinated and they don't have to be until an outbreak occurs in which there is not the same degree of herd immunity, like Disneyland in California or whatever, where the patients who have not been vaccinated will now be susceptible and very much at risk for getting the disease that is not just an inconvenience and a rash, but can cause serious side effects.
Thank you. So, talking about herd immunity, another important question that we get asked a lot is about pregnancy and receiving, say, the pertussis vaccine, which, most pregnant women are asked to get. So if someone's been diagnosed with transverse myelitis prior to becoming pregnant, should they get the whooping cough vaccine?
In general, I would say yes. I think it's got a tremendous safety record. We don't know of a specific association with these neurologic conditions. And based on the fact that we are still seeing infants each year dying from pertussis, we have to remember the reason for vaccinating mom is to ultimately protect the baby. And so it's obviously a personal choice, but I think the safety and the benefit far outweighs the risk.
And I would agree. I know of no evidence of, risking bringing a risk to either a pregnant mother or her fetus by vaccinating with either an inactivated virus or a tetanus toxoid, for example.
And on this point, Chitra, I think it's worth to reiterate one other aspect of this, and that is, at least from my perspective, there is nothing we do that is risk-free. So I am not here on the podcast to say vaccines are 100% safe, they're never ever going to cause a harm, take it because it's only good and not bad. We fully accept that there are unknowns out there. And when there are unknowns, that means there is a potential risk. But we also have to put it into the total view of why are we doing it and what's the potential benefit. And if we look elsewhere in medicine for hints of what we're willing to do without really giving it a lot of thought, it's pretty interesting. So, for example, anybody who's had a heart attack is going to go on aspirin or another medication. And people will go to the store and buy aspirin and take it every day and really not give it much thought. But the percentage of people who have major bleeding events has been statistically defined. We've seen it in every study. They can be life-threatening, life-changing events. And that rate is statistically going to be a log-fold higher than the complication rate of vaccinations, because we're having a hard time even measuring the impact of vaccinations, and yet with the aspirin we can do it. And yet there's not as much thought given to aspirin and major bleeding risks in patients who've had heart attacks or diabetics trying to prevent it. The vaccination world has come under scrutiny for a lot of different reasons, all of them legitimate, but we have to keep the relative risks in perspective. Unfortunately, this area, I think, has been mired by some bad science in the past, and even some science with political motives on both sides of the coin. And when trying to weed through what's out on the internet about any of these issues, it's a very scary and concerning area with people being adamant about certain things. And it's also hard from a human perspective if you've had a health event after anything, after a vaccination, or I hear the same thing after procedures. I had surgery, and then 2 weeks later I had transverse myelitis. Did the surgery cause it? It's very hard for us to ever shake the feeling that there was an association. But when we take a step back and look at the science, it's been hard to prove. And if there is one, it's going to be a very small one.
Thank you. That was very helpful. The last specific vaccination that we've gotten questions about is pneumonia vaccination, so the adult pneumovax. Anything you've heard, any research that suggests one shouldn't get the adult pneumovax vaccination?
I think I'll defer that one to you, Dr. Greenberg.
Yeah, we've been using the pneumonia vaccination, which is actually a combination of different serotypes of the streptococcal pneumonia bacteria, which can cause significant pneumonia or even meningitis in folks. It doesn't prevent all pneumonias. It's specific to certain organisms. I am not aware of cases of transverse myelitis associated with the pneumovax. I don't think if there have been reports of events following pneumovax, I don't think it would be at a higher disproportionate rate than we've seen with any other vaccination, frankly, and probably falls within that category of just what we would see by, excuse me, coincidence. Specific safety record of pneumovax, I think, has been one that's been extremely good.
Okay, thank you. And so now I would sort of love to sort of change gears and talk about, research and studies. So, are there any studies that are being done to even show, are there any correlations between vaccinations and rare neuroimmune diseases? Where are we in understanding and increasing awareness about, a link or no link, getting some clarity on these issues?
Well, if I can make a plug for two things at this point around that issue, and then also get Perry's input on different research going on. I'll jump at it. So one plug I'm going to make is there is a currently enrolling study for pediatric transverse myelitis patients called the CAPTURE study, which the TMA has been a lead advocate for. And what we're looking at is outcomes in children with transverse myelitis. We're specifically looking for kids within the first few months of their illness. So if anyone on the call hears of families or friends, while we hope that's not the case, if it does occur, please get them to the TMA to get signed on for the CAPTURE study. Part of the data we are collecting is about recent vaccination or infections, just so we can keep track, and it's one of the ways we're trying to collect data. The second plug I'll make is here at UT Southwestern, we do have a longitudinal study going for both transverse myelitis and neuromyelitis optica patients, where we are collecting vaccination data and trying to get a sense as to the relative rates of post-vaccination events, and is it higher than expected, or is it statistically what we would expect? One of the national approaches to this, and I can let Dr. Schreiner talk about this, is not a great one. It's called the VAERS system, the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System. And Perry, is this something you can speak to and give an explanation of?
Yeah, I can talk to that. So the VAERS, V-A-E-R-S, Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, is a monitoring system established by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention as a repository for anyone to report any occurrence, any health issue happening within a time period surrounding vaccination. So it is a self-reporting database, so to speak. So the data is only as good as what people report, but it is a means of bringing to a national body attention of something that may have had been influenced by having a vaccine. So this is publicly available data. I looked at it last night. You can, you know, query. I think there are 15,000 events in the last year, most of which were, you know, rash and skin type reactions, as I could tell. But it is publicly available. But it's also reviewed by the CDC to see if there are any trends in what is being reported. So this is something that I would encourage if you or someone you know you think has had an event that could be related. It doesn't, you know, obviously we've discussed the difficulty in causation, but if there is something that has happened in proximity to a vaccination, this would be one way of reporting it, of bringing it to a body, to a governing body. The other thing I will say about research in this area is that it's very difficult because we're looking for occurrences that are already very rare. So we have, you know, millions of people getting vaccinated. We're looking for a very rare occurrence, like transverse myelitis, optic neuritis, whatever. And so the studies that have the most robust data are studies that have been done in countries like Denmark or Sweden or even Canada, where they have 100% catchment. So they don't have an Aetna and Blue Cross and you know, care is provided within a national network, so everything can be collected and reviewed in large numbers. And so the data that we have that we feel pretty confident about when we look at potential impact of vaccinations comes from those very large systems, you know, an entire country of people being vaccinated, the most recent of which was a study that just came out about the HPV, human papillomavirus, that we haven't talked about yet. But this particular study was done in Denmark and Sweden over a 7-year period. And they looked at everybody that was vaccinated and everybody that was unvaccinated, and then whether or not there was any difference in the number of people who developed multiple sclerosis or any other demyelinating disease between those populations. And they found that there really was not any difference. And so this is a study that involved, millions, over about approximately 4 million people. And this is the kind of data that we feel good about when we know that we have looked at that many individuals being vaccinated, and we have some, and we don't see any indication that there is a link between a disease and the vaccination.
Great, thank you. Thank you for also covering the HPV vaccine question that, you know, we do get asked often about. Sort of in the last couple of minutes that we have during this podcast, you know, would you each be able to give us sort of take-home messages that we should be thinking about and be aware of? Can I start with you, Dr. Greenberg?
Yeah, I think the take-home messages, based on my read of the data and the experience, is that the mainly online, very strong, opinionated concerns over vaccine safety, I think have crept into our mindset, and I think exaggerate an issue that is, while potentially possible, much smaller in existence than anyone suggests. And one of the things I'll remind people is when you think anything has caused a bad harm, whether it be a procedure, a car accident, a vaccine, or a bad piece of sushi, you are 20 times more likely to post about it online or write about it or get involved in an action about it than for people who just have an event with no identifiable cause. And so we don't hear from the masses of people who just had transverse myelitis with no vaccination beforehand because they have no reason to post. And that's the overwhelming majority of patients. And so while I think as a scientist I have to absolutely concede the biologic possibility of a link, the practical implications of that based on the data is to say while there is risk, the benefits of vaccination far outweigh and are quite quantifiable the potential risk, both to ourselves, our families and loved ones, and the greater community, as well as in individuals who've already had an event. I think the safety of continuing with vaccination and the benefit that are achieved far outweigh the risk. So we are not blind or ignoring the potential link, but I think the data gives us a very reassuring place to be.
And I would agree. I think as we look at any medicine to start, any action to take, anything in our lives, we always have to balance the risks and the benefits. And without causing alarm, I would like to remind everyone to think about the risk that does come with infections, with primary infections of these diseases for which we now have vaccines. So there is a risk of not vaccinating. It is it can be severe, whereas we have a preponderance of evidence that shows that the risk of ill effect after vaccination is really quite small compared to the benefit. And so I would encourage a weighing of those options, not only with vaccinations, but truly with everything in life. We have choices, but in this instance, I would recommend vaccination. And I guess I'll throw in one caveat as well, which is that we are doctors, but we are not your doctors. And so having a discussion with your care provider about this as well would be something I would recommend so that you have a partner in the decision-making about the risks and the benefits. I hope this has been helpful to you.
This has been fantastic. Thank you both. It has been really, really helpful. And thank you for tackling what is clearly very controversial and very difficult issue. And as you said, you need a partner in making these decisions. You know, this podcast will be recorded and made available for those who haven't been able to listen in live to this conversation. And it's also downloadable on iTunes. And thank you both. Thank you, Dr. Greenberg. Thank you, Dr. Shiner, for giving us your time and for making this a very, very interesting.
Thank you.
Thank you.